Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
My Family Recipe is a new podcast from Food 52 and Heritage Radio Network, bringing you cherished heirloom recipes and the stories behind them. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, a food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn today. So this show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi, ramen, izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. My guests today are Tim Sullivan and John Puma, who are the hosts of the Sake Revolution podcast. The Sake Revolution podcast started in January 2020, and each episode is so informative and so much fun that I've never missed any episode of the show. And Tim is a sake expert and the founder of UrbanSake.com. He's also an honorable sake samurai as well. It is a title given by the Japanese Sake Brewers Association to those who promote sake and Japanese culture. He joined Japan Eats already twice in episodes 32 and 100. And John is also a sake expert and a founder of Sake Notes, which is a fascinating website all about sake. And I got lucky to be on their podcast, and we played the episode in episode 237. So listeners, if you have not listened to it, hopefully you will, and you'll get the idea of how fun and educational Sake Revolution is. So today, I'm sure many of our listeners have tried sake and started to like it, but not sure how to move on to the next step of discovering the fantastic and profound Japanese national beverage. So we'll discuss how you can proactively explore Japanese sake. Also, Tim and John brought a special sake, so they will teach us how to taste sake as well. But before we start, Japan Eats is available on the Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. Now, let's start a conversation with Tim Sullivan and John Puma. Hello, Tim. John, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi there.
So, this is exciting, and yes. We are in studios, so yeah. Real life. So, first of all, this is the best question to ask for our listeners to get to know you, and it's everybody's favorite question, it seems like. So, where are you from, and what did you eat when you grew up?
So I am actually from really close by in Queens. I grew up over in Flushing, and growing up, I was awful. I didn't eat anything. I mean, I ate plenty of things, but it was all junk food. So lots of chicken fingers and hamburgers when I was growing up. And I was very resistant to trying any kind of new foods.
Interesting. So, Tim?
And I am from Syracuse, New York, from upstate. And I grew up eating a very traditional American diet, chicken pot pie, steak on Sunday, and very, very traditional. No spices, nothing experimental. I think Taco Tuesday was as wild as it got. So.
Oh my God. Wow. This is the other side of the pendulum you grew up.
Yes.
Amazing. So, and could you tell us when and how you got into sake?
Well, I started drinking sake back in 2005, and it was my first time having premium sake ever. And it was so impressive to me that I wanted to study it more, and it kind of became my hobby. And then that morphed into my job. So from 2005 until today, it's been a whole growth in my interest in sake.
I actually had it on a trip to Japan in 2006, and I didn't fall in love right away. That really didn't happen until we got back to New York and found out that we can get sake here, and that there are izakayas here, sake bars here. So my friends and I started going to all of those sorts of places and really discovering sake, really getting into it. And it became a hobby. Now it's a much bigger hobby. It was a game-changing experience back then.
Right. So both of you mentioned the word hobby. So that's mm-hmm. the keyword. So from hobby to the next level sake experts like you, so you're a host of Sake Revolutions anyway. So how long did it take to gain your knowledge to become this beyond a hobby?
Mm. Well, I would answer that question by saying, if you love sake, you're going to be the eternal student. I'm always learning new things and always tasting new things. So it's very hard to call yourself an expert when you always have new and exciting experiences with sake. So I just say you have to dive in and you have to keep tasting and always be open to new things. And you'll never stop learning. That's what I feel.
I don't know if I'm an expert either.
That's what the best students say. And
I'm just a very avid student. I do like learning about it. I like tasting it, experiencing new things. Like Timothy said, it's always something new, always something that you didn't understand before, or maybe you thought you did. It's a lot of time in sake, like in language and stuff like that, when you get to the point where you think you understand it, you learn that you don't know anything.
Right. So it's like all the master and sensei in the Japanese, something dope way of like judo kendo. Everybody says, the top masters say, I'm just a student.
Yes.
So as I take you guys are. So for our listeners who want to discover Japanese sake, so what do you think is the best way to, like, one of them, I think you think is taking pictures, for example.
Yeah. I think, well, number one, get out there and try it. Try as many different types as you can. Try different styles. Definitely track what you tend to like. Take photos. We all have cameras in our pockets now. So there's no reason not to go in there. And every time you have something, take a photo of the front, take a photo of the back, maybe. And then jot some stuff down.
Yeah, I've done a number of tasting events where people come up to me and they're like, oh, you're a sake expert. I had an amazing sake once. It was in a blue bottle. And do you know that one? And that's why I always encourage people who are just getting into sake, maybe taking their first steps, always take a picture of the bottle and do something to remember the ones you liked, because you can bounce off those and find more in that same style.
Right.
I also find it's very useful when you have those photos and you go someplace new that may not have that sake. The person helping you out might have had that before. You say, hey, I've had this and I liked it a lot.
Mm.
You point to your phone, they might go, all right, that one, and then find something that's similar for you.
So maybe my question jumped up a little too quickly, but the point of taking pictures, it's almost try to impress yourself, just get the memory in your head so that you can make a reference for the next tasting, right?
Yeah. Another thing you can do in conjunction, John mentioned this a moment ago, is take notes.
Mm.
So when you write something down, it impresses more into your memory. So writing just a few words about the sake that you really liked, I think will help you remember, and you'll be able to recall it more quickly when you're in the liquor store or in the restaurant and you need to order something. You can remember the brand name or the region, and that can help you find something similar.
Right. Before you get too drunk, so that you're still reading words. No, just the world of Instagram and everything, taking pictures. But I think especially labels from Japanese sake can be, people try to create any beverage labels, but sometimes it's in Japanese language and you don't know what it means. So what's your impression of Japanese labels? Like,
we've been talking about this a lot on the show lately, so yes. It's very fresh in our minds, I think. And that is that, like, recently a lot of sake breweries have been kind of changing the labels a little bit, and not necessarily making them, just a bunch of English on there, but trying to make them seem a little bit more memorable, a little bit more modern. And it's something that we've been noticing a lot, and it's something that we think really does help Westerners who are new to sake keep track of this, you know, remember those models better. A lot of them have been doing like color coding, so they'll have like the same like logo with a different background or a different, you know, different foreground, and you just remember like, oh, I had this blue one with this symbol on it. I know I like that. And it's easy to remember. It's easy to kick that memory up when you see another bottle and you're, oh, I haven't had this one yet.
Yeah. And I think that when consumers are confronted with the very old-fashioned style labels that have lots of writing on them and are very packed with information and very old-fashioned designs like 1950s, 1960s looking, it can be very intimidating and maybe even hard to tell it's sake. So I always encourage people to look at labels they're really attracted to as well. Mm. That's a great starting point. You may not love it after you taste it, but if it's an attractive label and something that you're interested in, that's a great jumping off point for learning more about what you do like and what you don't like.
Right. But I have to say that, you know, the overseas sake market is growing fast thanks to experts like you guys. So Japanese sake producers are more aware. You have to adjust to the market so that it used to be like, you know, like Sony, like, make good products, people buy it. It's not that, that's not the attitude. It's not anymore. So, yeah. Okay. So, so you tend to pick yourself like more modern, like looking labels?
I mean, I might.
I mean, I think for us, we know the brands we like, we know the regions we like. So when we go to the store, we're pretty well prepared for what we may want to buy for ourselves or for the podcast. But for beginners that are just getting started, like I said, you can use that label as a jumping off point. But another thing that I recommend is for people to remember the prefecture. Now, Japan's made up of 47 prefectures or states. And if you find one sake, two sakes you like from Niigata or Yamaguchi, and you remember that prefecture name regionally, there may be other sakes in that area that match that style, use that rice, use that water source. And it's a great way to connect the dots and find more sakes you like.
Could you give us, I would say, two examples of very specific region-specific characteristics?
Do you want?
Yeah, I think I can do two rather quickly. So my favorite region for sake is Yamagata. Yamagata is known for having a very soft and fruity style of sake. And that's exactly where I like to go for sake. That's like my palate's happy place. And so that is often when I'm going someplace and I see something is from Yamagata, I will gravitate towards it because I know that is a pretty good chance that it's going to have some of those qualities that I really like. Another really good example is Niigata. Niigata has a very well-known, I want to say, style to it where a little bit dry, a little bit crisp, and goes great with food. Like that's like the Tim. Am I stepping out there? Is that exactly where they're at? All right.
But I'm just curious that you. Let's just dig it. What you said is soft and fruity, right? Mm-hmm. So why do you think you like it?
Why do I think I like it? Oh, that's a good question. I don't know. I think I just that's a like I like. Like lightly fruity things, and soft texture is really something that I really enjoy in sake specifically. It's not something I think about in a lot of other beverages, but when I'm having sake, that's something I'm always like on the lookout for.
So has it changed so far, like in the past, since 2006, has your preference changed?
Yes, but the first sake that I really like fell in love with had a lot of those qualities in it. And I can see, like, if I taste that old sake again, I can be like, oh, I can totally see how I got from here to my taste now.
Interesting. Super interesting. And what's that? Do you have that preference when you drink it on its own or you when you pair with food?
I like to focus on drinking sake on its own. You know, I'm not adverse to pairing, but for me, my ideal situation is I'm sitting on my couch, I have a little glass in my hand, and I'm sipping nice and slowly while something horrible is on TV. Mm.
Yeah, I'm very strictly, and when you go out with me, I'm just like totally want to taste like on its own, because that's what it is to me. But yeah, but what about you, Tim? What's your kind of favorite style?
Well, I lived in Niigata for 1 year. So the flavor profile that John was describing for Niigata, kind of crisp, clean, and light, I've come to really appreciate that. And it pairs very broadly. It's very refreshing on your palate. And, you know, sometimes if you have sakes that are too fruity or too rich, your palate can get tired out. But the light, clean style is easy to drink all night. And you can pair it with almost anything that hits the table. And it is really enjoyable, and it cleanses your palate too. So it refreshes your palate. Mm. So if you've been eating something that's a little fried, few sips of dry, clean sake, and then you can go on to sashimi or something else. Mm. So I've really come to appreciate and love this style from Niigata.
It's kind of your DNA. You trained yourself a lot.
But I love all kinds of sake, but you know, everyone has their personal preference, and that's totally fine.
Right. Interesting. Because I tend to prefer kind of like super dry. And then sometimes I used to dislike very rice, strong rice flavors. But then one day I had that kind of sake. And the next day when I'm walking on the street, I wasn't hungover or anything. It stays in my, nose or retinal nasal system. And that's like, I kind of like this. So I think my brain is kind of programmed to like it. And then next time I see it, it's like, oh, this is my kind of sake. So it's kind of transitional when it comes to what you like.
Yeah. I've seen many people's palates evolve over time. You know, John and I have been sake friends for many years, and we know many people that enjoy sake. And, you know, they might start out with something super fruity and juicy, and then they'll move to something more ricey and umami driven. And then maybe they'll end up loving really light and crisp things. So everyone's palate is going to evolve too. And that's wonderful.
Right. And then sometimes if you go to sushi omakase and like a special kinship burst or something, and you get sake pairings, then probably you'd never want to drink that sake without this food, or that kind of interesting combinations happen. And then that kind of very strong personality sake becomes your favorite throughout the course. So it's all about...
Yeah, that's a great way to learn about sake. So do an omakase and do the pairing, and someone set it up for you, and you can try different things. I love that, don't like that, this was my favorite. And it's a great way to learn.
Right. So because otherwise, if you don't know, you can't choose from yourself. So that's a part of education. So so the tuition is dinner and sake pairings. That's not bad. Okay. So so you're talking about taking notes, right? Mm-hmm. So what's on your list? Like, say, first of all, do you take notes on your phone or try to memorize it?
Years back, my wife actually made me a book. She actually had an Amazon published little a book with just a bunch of tasting pages on it. And so I often use that at home specifically. And that's been really easy to just kind of go, you got the date, you put the information about the sake, and then I taste it and I kind of just jot down what I'm thinking, how it makes me feel, what kind of aromas or tastes I pick up on, whatever, however it's moving me.
Wow. So what's on the list? You had opened a page, what?
Oh, so it's very, we want to do the aroma, and then it's very broad, how's that flavor, what does it do? And then we have a little chart of how sweet, how dry, was it a very front forward, how was the finish, things like that. Mm. And it really does, it kind of helps me understand my own tastes, and also how do I put this? Because I have to, I don't always know if my language is going to be something that translates well. So I've not had every fruit out there. So if I read a tasting note that says something tastes or smells like dragon fruit, I don't know what that necessarily smells like. So sometimes I will, be sniffing sake, and I'm like, God, this, I don't know what this is. It's very interesting. What is that? And I'll kind of jot that down and be like, some kind of a fruit. It's very tangy. Blah, blah. Mm. And then I'll maybe look at somebody else's notes on the same sake and be like, oh, wait a minute. Okay. So this is what they're correlating it to. Mm. And that'll help me communicate that to other people in the future. But really the notes for the most part are for me, and they're for me to understand myself.
Mm. So it's kind of a base for your building your own dictionary.
Right.
Kind of. Wow.
Yeah. But I want to caution people as well. Sometimes they almost think of it like a test. I have to take notes and I'm going to fail if I don't know how sweet or dry it is. I met a woman once who her sake tasting notes consisted of smiley face ratings. So one smiley face, didn't like it too much. Three smiley faces, really good. Four smiley faces, my favorite. Mm. So that worked for her. And she wrote it down and she used that to remember. She'd write the name of the sake and the smiley faces. Like, even that is awesome. Mm. Because it helps you remember the name and how much you liked it. And it's all about enjoyment at the end of the day. It's not a test. It's, you know, it's writing is just as much as it can be of service to you. Mm. That's how much you should write.
Go ahead.
I used to think there was a lot of pressure on me to try and get these notes right and to have my language correlate to everybody else's. But it doesn't always work that way. You know, it's just some sake makes you feel a certain way sometimes when you're sipping it, and you can put that in your own words. And as long as you understand it, that's the important thing.
Mm. Right. And also it's a kind of practice to try to expand your kind of that efforts to explore, like, what is this, what that? And even if you don't get there, it's fun. And then usually at the end, even if I can't just pin down the word, I just say, put a stomach. 1, 2, 3 stomachs. So that's my rating.
Love that.
Yeah. So, but do you, Tim, do you have a system to record?
Yeah, I take notes on my phone. And since 2005, I've been running a website called Urban Sake. Mm. And I have a database of over 1,000 sakes on there with a picture of the bottle. I'm a very visual learner, so I can remember what the bottle looked like. So I always, always include a picture. Mm. And then the stats about the sake, the rice milling rate. I'm a nerd, so I'm really interested in all the numbers. And then if I have any important comments, I'll write a very short tasting note. For me, it doesn't have to be a long paragraph talking about, you know, shoe leather and passion fruit and all this. So I keep it very simple. And again, it's what serves me, what helps me remember. Mm. So that's what I recommend to people.
Right. That's if I want to find reference, that's you, my go-to place.
Thank you.
Right. But actually, you have sake notes, right? Mm-hmm. So that's your website. And that's kind of like a summary of your learning.
Yeah. So it was, it rarely update anymore, unfortunately. But it was something that my wife and I were doing together. And it was kind of like a sake photo blog. And then also we had some like videos that we were doing on the side, and it was just like, I wanted to do something. I wanted to whenever I have a hobby, we talked about how this was a hobby. Whenever I have a hobby, I get way too into it and I need to contribute something to the conversation. And so that was like my first attempt at what I'm going to contribute. Mm. And it was a lot of fun to do. We hosted tasting events that were associated with that brand also. And then obviously we stopped doing that when the pandemic started. But, in the interim, we started doing this this podcast. That's been where a lot of my energy has gone.
Right. I think any outlet very responsibly created, that's very important, because still English sake information websites are very limited. Mm-hmm. So yours are amazing. So congratulations. I hope you're going to keep doing it. all right. The sake, maybe you can just, well, because it's the listeners probably want to like, what exactly my notes should be. So do you have maybe details, some sort of checkpoints?
I wish I had my book on me.
There's a few things that I look at. And it's very similar if you're used to doing a wine tasting notebook, or you take little notes about the wines you're enjoying or the beers you're enjoying. It's no different for sake. You want to look at the color of the sake first, then give it a sniff, make any notes about the aroma, and then give it a taste. And when I taste it, I pay attention to how sweet and dry it is, what flavors I taste, and then the finish. The aftertaste of the sake is really important too. Mm. So in a nutshell, those are the points that I hit when I'm taking a quick note about a sake.
Mm, right. So it's not as complicated as you think.
No.
Right. Okay. All right. So we'll take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll taste a sake and practice what we have just discussed. So please stay with us.
Good food is worth a thousand words. This is Aarti Menon, and I'm delighted to share a new podcast with you, My Family Recipe, from Food 52 and Heritage Radio Network. Adapted from Food 52's much-loved column of the same name, the My Family Recipe podcast will bring its pages to life. Each episode of My Family Recipe brings you a cherished heirloom recipe and the story behind it, from voices across the world of food.
We'd open these tubs of dough and they would exhaust these incredible yeasty fumes, and it just smelled like nothing else. It was so intoxicating.
I'll interview writers and chefs, parents and children, about what's passed down along with the foods that we know and love.
Chinese people aren't like born with a download on how to like velvet chicken. You know, like that's not something that just like comes to you.
Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, and my guests today are Tim Sullivan and John Puma, who are the host of Sake Revolution podcast. So you brought a beautiful sake. So we'll taste it together and learn how to approach a new sake and take notes. So, but first, what is the background? I mean, what is the sake and what is the background of this sake?
Well, this is a sake from a brand called Masumi out of Nagano Prefecture. And this is their Hiyao Roshi. That is a fall release nama sake. And this is a seasonal style of sake that is really, really delicious. They brew it in the wintertime, they pasteurize it once, and then they let it age over the summer. And then it's released without a second pasteurization.
Right.
So it's considered a Namazume style or Hiyaroshi. And it is really, really great example of this style. And because it's in season now, fall is just starting, we really wanted to bring something that was unique and seasonal for you to taste.
Right. So listeners who wants to know these details, Namazume and Hiyaroshi, listen to Sake Revolution.
Yes.
Right. But basically, some sake is usually pasteurized twice to prevent any, you know, problems later. So this one is just pasteurized once.
Yes.
And it's released in the fall.
Yeah.
So that really indicates sake is a very seasonal product.
Absolutely.
Yes. All right. So let's open. Sound effect. So we're just pouring. Hopefully, listeners, you heard the delicious sound of pouring sake. So let's see. How do you evaluate first?
Well, I give it a quick look in the glass and see if I see any color. Most sake is clear, so usually you won't see much color, but you want to see how clear it is, how transparent it is, and if there's any shade of yellow or a little bit of amber color, you just want to pay attention to that. This is relatively clear, just a hint of something yellowish. And next, I would give it a smell.
Mm.
Mm. Mm, smells great.
It does.
Fruity.
Yeah, it's fruity, okay. But isn't there a richness there as well? It's not like fresh tropical fruit, but more rich and concentrated fruits.
I'll take some butterscotch underneath. Mm.
Yeah. So a concentrated sweetness.
Mm.
And then, after you've enjoyed the aroma, you want to give it a taste.
Hmm.
Mm.
Wow.
Ooh.
Yeah.
The taste is concentrated. There's a viscosity.
Yes.
In it.
Yeah. There's a hint of sweetness and really nice finish as well.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
there's a nice little richness in there, like you mentioned, on the nose. And it's really playing nicely with the fruit and with the sweetness. It's really, really well balanced in that way.
Right. And then just like aftertaste, little slight acidity. Mm-hmm. And then this viscosity keeps that taste last longer.
Yeah. For me, sipping on this sake, instead of being bright, juicy, and fresh, it tastes a little bit more rounded and more on the aged side. So there's a that kind of concentrated flavor you can get with sakes that are laid down for a little bit longer. Mm. They get a richness to them. And that really comes across on the taste to me.
Right. So if this the same sake was released, bioactive was made in spring, there could have been that fresh, juicy.
Exactly.
Lively.
That's exactly right.
Right. Mm-hmm. And this is probably more better with food from autumn. So.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. It's becoming the season now where people are starting to think about hot pot dishes or stews or nabe, things like that. And they have a little bit of richness and warmth to them. And I think this sake would pair beautifully with that, like a tofu nabe or something like that.
Right.
Yeah.
Dashi.
Yes,
rich
exactly.
Rich flavor. Right. But what about Western food? How would you pair this kind of food?
Mm. Well, you know what's coming up, which is also seasonal, is Thanksgiving. So if you think about roast turkey, mashed potatoes, cranberry sauce, this would be the sake to bring to Thanksgiving dinner, in my opinion.
I think
Mm-hmm. I think it can really stand up to those very comforting flavors that we all love as Americans, turkey and mashed potatoes. This would go great with that.
Right. And then I started to taste more like a chestnut, so that could be another chestnut sweets.
Yeah, of course.
Yes, I definitely have Thanksgiving ideas now.
Okay.
I think even like daily, you know, roast chicken.
Yeah, that could absolutely. Be, roast chicken, right? On the weekend. Yeah.
Crispy skin, and this would be perfect. Yeah. So what kind of sake do you normally pick? Like, it's just very random personal questions, but like when you go to a liquor store that you like, what's your like criteria? Like,
all right. So I like to pick a sake that I can infinitely sip. Something that's very, very, very sippable, very crushable, I think is what Tim likes to say. And that is, you know, something that you're sipping in, you're enjoying the flavor. The finish is nice and crisp, and then you want to sip it again.
Mm.
And know that's a dangerous style of sake, but I think it's really lovely, and really, it's one of the nice things that sake does so well is that it can have that situation where you're just kind of being led into the next sip and can just have another one.
Right. I mean, if you have very strong wine, which is like 15, 16% potentially, at the same alcohol level as wine. So,
yeah. I mean, I don't know if John actually does this, but on the podcast, we talk all the time about him relaxing after work with a glass of sake on his couch. So
I definitely do.
Okay, good.
Yeah. So what about you, Tim?
Well, there's some sakes that I love to drink for study. That means you pay attention when you drink them and you try to learn and you dig deep. And those are wonderful. But for personal enjoyment, I like sakes that I don't have to think about too much. So I have brands that I like. After all these years of drinking sake, I have my favorite brands and my favorite regions. So I know what to reach for if I want something to just relax. So it's a very similar story to what John said. However, I really enjoy drinking all styles of sake. For me, some require a little bit more attention than others. And sometimes you just want to kick back and take it easy.
Right. Well, I know your New Year's resolution, according to the second revolution, you have to get out of your comfort zone. Yeah. So
well, now everyone knows how my New Year's resolution is going.
You're doing it. You're succeeding.
Yes.
Right. But I don't know. I know, John, your wife, you said on Sake Dogoroshi, she's adventurous. I'm like that. Like, mm-hmm. what's strange? What's weird?
I mean, you two have very similar tastes in sake. yeah, and she has her crazy style that she likes. And oftentimes I will sip something that she really enjoys, and I'm very happy that it's there for people who enjoy it, but it's just not for me. And actually is a thing that makes me happy when that happens, because there's a sake out there for everybody. Mm. Every sake, I don't have to love every sake. They're not all made for me. They're made for other people too.
Right. That's the whole point, isn't it? Right. So it's like your favorite show on Netflix or something like that. It's just as you wish. You just feel like it, then you take notes if you want to. And then, so do you have any other reference? Of course, your websites, right? But any books or any other resources or courses, classes, anything?
Well, I teach some classes with the Sake School of America. So I've been a teacher with them for many years, and we have different levels. If you want to get a little bit more involved in sake on a professional level or earn a certification, so that's a course that I teach, and it's now offered online since the pandemic. Mm. And that's great. If you want to take the next step and go a little bit deeper into sake, I really recommend the Sake School of America.
Mm. What's the website?
SakeSchoolofAmerica.com. All one word. Yep.
Mm. Okay. And
For me, I like to kind of get in the weeds a little bit when I'm learning about a brand or a brewery or a sake. I have a sake that I really liked. I want to find out about them. So I'm gonna look them up on the internet. I'm gonna look up if they have a Japanese site. I'm gonna try to find the Japanese site. Google Translate is really, really good these days, and you can find out a lot about their other offerings. A lot about like how they make sake, what kind of rices they use. And it's all very readable, and it'll help you kind of understand the brewery a little bit better. I think that's a fun thing. It wasn't always available to us because Google Translate was a little shaky for a long time. But these days, it does a really good job.
Mm. Yeah, when I do any research for writing or podcast, and I go to Japanese sake brewers website, there's like their soul is there, passion and love and everything. It's very much in it. So everything's so expressive and history and their philosophy. So, okay, I didn't know that Google Translate it's much better than before.
It was there were some rough times.
I know.
Yeah, you have to be a little bit of a detective sometimes. Right. If you find a sake you love, no English website, what John said, put it in Google Translate and see what you get. You can learn a lot. For us, it's really fun to do.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
And even better, if you can travel again. Not right now, especially to Japan, but I think it's coming up. We can start traveling. So how do you visit breweries?
We do it very differently from one another.
Okay.
Our Japan travel is polar. We're very opposite in that way. Tim, why don't you give us your ideal trip to Japan?
Well, what John's referring to is that when I go to Japan, I pack in absolutely every brewery visit I can muster, sometimes two a day if they're in the same town. So a minimum of one brewery a day, traveling all around the country with my Japan Rail Pass. And I just try to pack in as much as I can if I'm there for 2 weeks. And that's not what John does at all.
Now, when I go to Japan, I'm on vacation. So I like to visit maybe two cities, maybe a third for a few days. And my goal mostly is to just kind of get a feel for the local izakaya and sake scene. I really love going to local bars and local izakayas and in a given city and finding what kind of hidden gems they have, find out like what kinds of sakes they're into, because it's not always the local sake. Sometimes there's very popular brands in parts of the country that you would not expect. They're like very far away from where they're originating. And I do try to put in a brewery visit every trip. Mm. So, but I try to limit it to just the one, because I think that's going to the brewery is very involved. Sometimes they're, Tim can attest to this, sometimes they're a little out of the way to get to. But I like to just try to keep it as light as possible. Mm. And then again, we'll have like that one day where we have an appointment, we go to the brewery, we see everything that they are doing, and they're always fascinating. We always learn so much. But it is, we don't like to do appointments when we're, when we're on vacation.
Right. Yeah, I'm like that. I just like wake up in the morning and then I don't know what to do today, but I'm going to do something new, different.
But it's going
to
be fun.
Right, exactly. You decide. It's going to be fun. Right. But I think, you know, like even if you just stop in just very popular, no appointment place, and then you go out for dinner that night and like, oh, wow, that's the sake you taste at the brewery. And it's like, I don't know, just that special feeling of I know that place. Makes it even more delicious. So, yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, I have always said that when I started visiting breweries 13, 14 years ago, my admiration for sake went through the roof because you saw with your own eyes how much hard work goes into making sake. Blood, sweat, and tears, literally. So my appreciation for sake grew tremendously when I started seeing where it was made. And I always say in my classes, sake is not a liquid in a bottle. It is really also the people that make it. And when you visit a brewery, any chance you get, it's a great way to appreciate that.
Right. And also you actually became a part of that blood and the tears.
Some of my sweat is in there.
Hopefully not too much.
No.
Oh, salty.
Just a whisper.
Right. Yeah, so how do you, where do you go? I mean, like, say, New York City, and everywhere else, and anywhere else. Where do you go to taste sake?
Well, I can talk about New York. We've been here for the pandemic, with no travel for me. So there's a few places I love. One place I love to go to is a very well-known Decibel. It's a sake bar underground in the East Village. And the last time I was there, I actually had the Masumi Hiyaroshi. So I recently went there, and this was their seasonal sake on offer. So I had a chance to try this, and it just blew my socks off. You know, it was amazing. So you can always try something fresh and new there. And it has a great selection. And, you know, it's a great thing to do before dinner, after dinner. They're usually open pretty late, and it's a great place to try a variety of sake.
It's almost like the must place, the home of sake, this in history too.
I'm in New York, because again, we haven't been traveling. In New York, I've been venturing over to Industry City more often because you know, a lot of good restaurants over there that have a lot of Japanese food and a lot of good sake selections like Waku Waku. We can visit Brooklyn Kuro while we're there and see what kinds of things they've been up to and taste their new sakes. And then Kurichi, do get a bottle of something that you enjoyed while you were over there. It's a nice little area. They get all these things done in one session, I guess, in one day.
Well, it's amazing, right, how many new things are happening in terms of sake. And I just got a newsletter for the new season school classes invitation from WSET, which is, you know, the wine and other beverage tasting. This is like a sake-specific course they even offer. So like, wow, sake came a long way.
Yeah.
Amazing.
For sure.
Right. Okay. So I know you are really great at Sake Revolution. And do you have any plans about the podcast and beyond?
And beyond.
I mean, dreams, plans.
I don't know, Timothy. What do you
merch, mean? Merch.
Merch. Yeah, we're going to be launching some stuff. We've had people ask us about shirts a lot, and we've been trying to find a good supplier for shirts. And hopefully in the near future, we will have a supplier figured out, and then we'll start doing that sort of thing.
Yeah, and the other thing we talk about all the time on the show is travel. So when it's safe to travel again, we would love to do a show from Japan or from another part of the country and go on location. That was our original idea. And the pandemic started right when our first few episodes were coming out. Right. So we ended up on Zoom instead of traveling from location to location. So when things evolve over the next year, I would love to see us travel to Japan, do some on-location episodes, and have guests that we can visit their brewery, visit their restaurant, and talk to them right there.
Mm, I can't wait.
Mm, I'm all right with visiting the brewery to do an episode there. That's great.
All right.
But then afterwards, you've got to come to one of our favorite bars in the city.
Deal.
Okay.
Yeah. And then I think it's really, you know, Japan's vaccination rate exceeded America now. Mm-hmm. They started so late, but, you know, once they decide, they just do it.
Yes.
So I think a whole banning, like, you know, quarantine things is going to be lifted sometime soon. So
I hope so.
I'm ready.
Yeah,
I'm
right. Ready. Yeah. So
I'm very much ready.
So in terms of sake evolution, I mean, you have very interesting, like, you know, some series of sake rise to very kind of fun, but very well structured. So I'm going to stay that format, like.
So we sometimes we'll do a bunch of episodes around, you know, around a style of episode or format, like the rice episodes, the wild rice series, where every episode we taste sake that uses a specific type of rice, and we'll talk about the history of the rice, where it originated, and then really kind of talk about what that brings to the sake. And those have been a lot of fun, and we're going to keep doing those. But lately, we've been doing more brand or brewery focused episodes. I think we've been calling that branded. I like the name. And those have been a lot of fun because they're just a really great excuse to talk about and focus on really fun sake. Mm. And that's been great for us.
Yeah, I've been really enjoying this deep into the background.
Yeah. One thing that we decided was really important to both of us was including a tasting in every episode. Mm. We didn't want it to be just us talking about Yamada Nishiki for 30 minutes and then say, okay, thanks for joining us. You know, we really want the experience. And if people want to, you know, learn about sakes without having to go out and buy a bottle necessarily, you can listen to our podcast, make a note of what we tasted. If it sounds good based on our description, that might be a good one for you to try. Mm. So we taste a lot of sakes, so you don't have to.
Right. And, it's a really compact 30 minutes, and then about half of it, that's a tasting process with the background details. So the practice we had, you do every time. And I learned a lot.
Thank you so much. Yeah. It's a lot of fun.
Mm. Yeah.
So where can we find Sake Revolution?
You can find Sake Revolution at sakerevolution.com. But more importantly, you can find it on your podcast platform of choice. We're on just about all of them. I think Tim handles all of that. And he does a really good job of getting us out there.
Yep. We're also on Instagram at Sake Revolution Pod, and on Twitter and Facebook. So you can find us pretty much everywhere. But the website is a great home base.
Mm. Right. And that's where we can get the updates on merch.
Yes.
Yes. And the show notes.
You guys do the show notes very, very well. So,
I think with sake, especially with the bottles, it's very important you see what we're talking about a lot of the time. So if you go to the site, you can see exactly what the bottle looks like. A lot of the time, Tim will go and find pictures of the breweries if we're doing an episode on a brewery. And those are always really fascinating to look at. Mm. And then sometimes Tim's in those photos at the breweries. Those are a lot of fun, too.
Right. So, yeah. So last episode, you visited a photo shooting, and then you took the sakedama.
Yes.
And then you get drenched because there's a lot of the water in sakedama.
I had a mishap, but that's one fun thing is that John and I can both tell stories about our trips to Japan, what went well, what didn't go well, what we tasted, what weird food we ate. And I think that for us, since we can't travel right now, it's even more fun to reminisce about these experiences. But you can read all about it in the show notes. So check it out on the website for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that to summarize, I don't have to summarize because there's so much in here, but I think the sake is fun. And then you are having fun together to discover it too. And after listening to your podcast, I have a smile on my face always.
I'm so glad. That's great.
Thank you.
So good luck. And hopefully you're going to come back for more.
We'd love to. Anytime.
Yes, anytime you want. We're not that far away.
Right, that's true. All right. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for short topics or guests, please contact us at japaneats@heritageradionetwork.org or kikukatema.com. Japan Eats is a weekly program and always available at heritageradionetwork.org. www.fooddoc.org, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. And so, Tim, John, thank you for joining us. And our engineer today is Armin Svensson. And thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Japan Needs is powered by Simplecast. Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network, Food Radio supported by you. For freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a non-profit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thank you for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.